life is short and there's much to do. So, I most of my life until now, I balanced multiple responsibilities. Actually, this is probably the first time in my life that I'm really focused on one thing, and finally shied away from this double life of multiple responsibilities, you know, juggling careers. So yeah,
that is the thing you have been focusing on most has been composing, I believe, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I started out, like, the short version, the short biography is I discovered music when I was 3 years old. So my earliest memories in life are being 3 years old, sitting in the basement of my parents' house and studying Beethoven's Ninth. And sort of that's where it started. And because I was a bit of an odd kid that way, my parents got me a teacher, a music teacher, which was like music theory and learning how to read score and etc. So I was reading score before I could read language. And she was also a piano teacher. So the natural transition was from studying theory with her to studying piano. And so that eventually resulted in me becoming a concert pianist at the National Academy in Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And having a career as a classical pianist, being a member of numerous rock bands at the same time, and having a mother who said you can play as much piano as you want, but you're going to university to study medicine as well. And to keep everybody happy, I did both. And then within 1 year, I graduated from the academy and from med school, and then was invited to pursue a career in cardiology, and then still gave concerts throughout. But once I had finished cardiology and went into what is called interventional cardiology, so minimal invasive cardiac surgery, that's when I decided to transition from playing and giving concerts to composing, sort of shying away from having a dual audience, like patients in the daytime and, you know, like seeing the same people in the crowd at night with a concert. That was not comfortable. Mm-hmm. So then I switched to composing, and I've been doing that ever since, until fast forward, my mom then in her early 90s came back to me over dinner saying, enough is enough. You've spent enough time juggling two careers. Why don't you, you've done enough with medicine. Why don't you go back to focusing on music? And so that was about, you know, 35 years later, right? And I go like, Mom, you're telling me only now? And she said, yep, enough is enough. Focus on your music. So, you know, I started out doing as my mom told me, and I think I still am. Right?
Yeah, and it's wonderful compared to so many famous stories of composers of old who felt pressured to say, was it Berlioz or others, go into medicine or go into law, and they, you know, pushed themselves, but finally broke, you know, sort of went away from it and just couldn't. But you found a path to incorporate both as long as you could.
Yes. There's no really breaking away from anything, because I never felt a negative pressure in whatever it is I did. So whatever it is you do, whatever it is you choose doing, once you do it, you might as well enjoy it and do it to the best of your abilities. I think that that's a healthier approach to life in general. So, you know, like you can't, as we say, you can't control circumstances, but you can control the way you deal with the circumstances. And so if the reality is this way or that way, well, then embrace the reality and do it to the best of your ability. There's a there's an is an old Jewish, for sure, not an Orthodox Jewish expression, but a Jewish expression in Dutch. If you eat pork, which of course you're not supposed to, right? Mm-hmm. But if you eat pork, you might as well let it drip over your chin. So you do something, you embrace it wholeheartedly. So I didn't feel pressured. And I very deeply enjoyed everything that I did with my medical career, especially the relationship with patients, with people in general. It was wonderful. So no regrets.
And actually, that sense of not regretting ties into one of the works that I have a recording of, which is your symphony number 1, Remember to Forget. And I was really struck by what you described finding in the biography of composer Georges Ligeti and how he responded to adversity in his life.
It's probably not a surprise that I felt drawn to his story, to his biography, for that very same reason. So life is full of adversity. You get into situations you cannot control, but you can always control yourself in the way you respond to what is happening, right? And his biography is full of that, and I admire that a lot. If you read what it is he has gone through in his life and what he ultimately achieved, I was deeply impressed. So when I was commissioned to write that symphony for an occasion, it was around the time of his passing. So I was a moment to read his biography and go like, wow. And that greatly inspired me in writing that music.
In listening to the music, whether with the program or without it, I'm very struck by the clarity of the textures. It's really beautiful the way the different instruments come out, and also the moments where something dramatic happens in the music that is stressful or intense, but then the way it resolves into the rest of the music. Could you talk a little bit about what you were doing when you were approaching the instrument that is the orchestra and writing for it?
That's actually not an easy story, in the sense that more often than not, when I embark on writing a new work, whether it was that symphony or the second symphony or the concerto, it's more often than not a situation where before I start composing, I actually have almost a visual image of a work, like I said, in terms of architecture, and then it sounds maybe a little bit spooky, but the work comes to me in almost in a complete fashion, and then I just sit down and write it down. And in that sense, I always question myself if I'm a composer. I don't know what it is I'm doing. Like composing sounds like, you're in your studio 9 to 5 and you crunch notes and you think and you sketch and I hardly sketch at all. It starts with the layout of the orchestra. So I don't write music on the piano and then I orchestrate. It's the other way around. Right from the start, I know the size of the band or like who plays, right? What the instruments are, what the colors are. And then I write straight into full score. And more often than not, the writing down of the piece does not take very much more time than the duration of the piece when you play it. So like it's sort of a stream of conscious or stream of subconscious, right? So from that point of view, I find it challenging to talk about style or technique. It's more a matter of feeling deep gratitude over the fact that I'm being handed over something which I then receive and just move forward, like write down and share. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel some of your sense of the orchestra, its space and its sounds, probably comes from a lot of that deep listening that it seems you've done since a young age?
Oh, for sure, for sure. Like, absolutely. It's easy to stand on the shoulders of giants. So I started listening really seriously to music as I told you at the age of three. With Beethoven, and I must have been a bit of a weird kid. I was studying Bruckner symphonies at the age of six, and then discovered Mahler when I was 12 or 13, and of course now many years later, I've studied in the sense of listening and reading score, from the late Middle Ages until now. So I've consumed much or most of what was written and has remained from all different styles and different eras, different styles, different techniques, and the people we know, the obvious ones, are giants because they are giants, and they were so good at what it is they were doing, and so grateful to learn from those scores. And it's like being a chef, and you go to a restaurant, you eat a steak, and you say, "Wow, this is extraordinary!" And you ask for the recipe, like how did they do that, right? And that's the same with scores. How did they create that sound? And you learn from that.
In both of your symphonies that I have a recording of, the idea of remembering or remembrance is there, but it seems in very different ways. One which is moving beyond personal memories of trauma, and the other is still remembering stories of those who have been lost and who experienced difficult things, and the importance of continuing to remember those. Could you talk a bit about your second symphony, The Children's War Diaries?
Yeah. Well, Children's War Diaries started with reading the diaries of five teenagers who were murdered during the Second World War. Now, the one diary is the obvious one that most people might know, the Anne Frank diary, and it became very popular, I think, because if you read it, you read a beautiful diary by a very wise child, a wise girl beyond her years, who wrote about an ideal of what the world should be like while she was in hiding. And as she was writing the diary, she was not a witness to any atrocities because she was in hiding. And the moment that she did become a witness to atrocity, she was no longer writing. And so that makes it for an idealistic, beautiful read for mostly a high school audience. The other four that were found later are actually a very tough read. It's four kids in Eastern Europe who actually, as they write, witness atrocities. Like I'm looking out the window and I see them, beat my father to death. Like, very difficult read. That I remember one of them ending with, "Oh, somebody's knocking at the door, I have to go." But that, of course, was the moment of her own arrest and being deported and then shortly after being murdered. Very impressive diaries of teenagers. And a few years after reading those diaries, I was on a visit to the Holocaust Memorial Research Center in Jerusalem, where they have a children memorial pavilion dedicated to the memory of 1.5 million children who were murdered, which makes up about 95% of all children in the ages of 0 to 18 years old in occupied Europe. And the architecture is quite overwhelming. It's very sober. It's very very impressive. And going through that memorial and then stepping back out the building into the blazing sunlight, a similar experience that I just described before happened, that I actually, walking through that memorial, saw and heard a symphony that connected to the diaries that I had written before. So again, I went home and wrote down those five movements, reflecting the five diaries. And that is the second symphony. Now, the reason to not only to write it, but to publish it and to record it, is that I firmly believe that for a child, or any person, any age for that matter, it really doesn't matter what page of the history book you are on when you're a subject of war. When you're a victim of war, you don't really care where that fits in history, or, you know, like what country you were born in, etc. War is horrible and terrible and should never happen. And when you're a victim to war, you're a victim to war, period. And it's... So whether that is children from the Holocaust, which for most people is, you know, black and white pictures in another century in a country very far away, it's equally true for surviving kids from Rwanda or the, you know, former Yugoslavia in the 90s, or, you know, more recently Iraq and Syria, etc., or Afghanistan. So I think what I think I try to capture in the second symphony is the emotional trauma on people who are subjected to the evil of war.
That is, I believe I read somewhere recently, someone said history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes, which is this sort of parallel to the different pasts and what we see going on now, yeah, even in our world.
Yep. Yes, true. Well, of course, I would say the ugly truth is that very often history does repeat itself, and it's mostly because of a lack of knowledge of history that people are doomed to repeat it. I mean, that's why that expression is so powerful, because it's probably, and unfortunately, it's true. But whether it repeats or rhymes, yeah, it keeps, yeah, coming back in unexpected twists and turns. And usually when you don't expect it, right? Mm-hmm.
So. That is, if it's okay to ask, you mentioned, you know, some of the history of the Holocaust for many people is older photos or stories in black and white. But in your life, your mother, who you've mentioned, was also a survivor of that time and of the camps. And so I was wondering, had she told you stories when she was young, when you were younger, or was it only when she published her book that you learned something?
Yeah, both my parents were survivors of the concentration, of the death camps. So yes, of course I grew up with hearing stories. And so my parent, mostly my mother, my father not so much, but my mother was capable of sharing stories, in the sense of, you know, sharing stories of her family before the war, or, you know, no one of whom came back. Like, she was this. Both my parents were sole survivors of their respective families. So yes, I did hear stories, and sort of, you know, like whoever was a survivor of that community in Amsterdam, of which there were not many. I think there's only a few hundred Dutch Jews who survived Auschwitz. It's like it's unfortunately not too many people. But these people tended to know each other, right? Because they came back from that same experience. And so I did hear stories, and of course I read about it, so it was not foreign to me. Of course, I asked a lot of questions, you know, like when I was in a public school, but at the age of, you know, 7, 8, I realized I was the only kid in school who had no grandparents, no uncles, no aunts, no cousins, no nephews, etc. And so why is that? So, so I was aware of that history for sure.
I guess that has me generally thinking whether with music or in telling of stories, a sort of broader question of the role of memory and remembrance, whether it is connecting to individual people, whether it is remembrance of things that we should not forget because they are troubling and we should avoid them in the future, or trying to hold on to some of the better things of the past. What sense does memory or looking back play for you in life or in music?
That's a good question. I think what the reason I chose the subtitle for the first symphony as Remember to Forget is I think it's a very important an important concept. Remember to Forget is a sentence from is taken from a sentence in the Old Testament. It's in your daily morning prayers, where it says you have to remember to forget Amalek. Amalek was the tribe that witnessed, you know, if you know and believe that story, that the Hebrews came out of Egypt through the splitting of the sea, and they came into Sinai, Mount Sinai, and that first thing that happened is God came down and gave them the Ten Commandments, which was the start of a society ruled by law, right? Not by power, it's what they had left behind, but a society ruled by law. And that event was witnessed by a tribe called Amalek, and they said, let's instill doubt on these people such that we can destroy them. And so the daily sentence, remember to forget, is linguistically interesting, because if you have to forget something, you forget it, it's forgotten, it's gone. But here you are daily, on a daily basis, reminded to remember to forget something. And the meaning of that sentence, the psychological layer below that sentence, is that if you forget who you are, you're lost. So the connection of forgetting who you are is connected linguistically to the word doubt. So doubt is self-destructive. That is the intention or the meaning of that sentence. So if you say, I should have, I could have, I would have, that is self-destructive. On the contrary, if you're self-critical, you review your thoughts and your words and your actions, and you're critical about that with the intention to improve yourself, that is positive. That's how you grow and how you move forward. But doubt is self-destructive. So you have to remember to forget. You have to remember who you are in order to be able to be a wholesome person or truthful person, and to move on and to make this a better world. And so from that perspective, remembering, I think, is an important thing. You always have to do the best you can under all circumstances. On the other hand, which is maybe also, you know, more reflected in the Second Symphony with Children's War Diaries, I don't know if it's different or more of the same. It's like, if you don't know your history, if you don't know where you come from, you have a bit of a hole in your identity. And when you have a hole in your identity, you can never play your part in life as a person who contributes to society in general to the fullest extent. And that is society in the bigger sense of the word. So I think as human being, in my medical career, I had the privilege of traveling a lot. I worked all over the world, practically everywhere, except for the North Pole and the South Pole. And so the more you travel, the more you come to realize that, you know, we're all the same, we're all connected, we all have the same needs and wishes and dreams, and we all belong to, you know, one and the same species, and we're all connected, and we all come from God, right? And so in order to contribute to a peaceful society, you have to, I think, accept that truth lives in a respectful and peaceful acceptance of difference of opinion, because there's always difference of opinion between people. And that's okay, as long as you keep that respectful and peaceful. And we all have a responsibility towards each other to build a better, healthier, stronger, and more peaceful society. And I think it really helps to know who you are, what you are, where you come from, in order to have a clearer image of where we need to go to. So, sorry if this is a very long answer on the point of remembrance, but that's how I think about that.
That is beautifully stated, and so thank you. And it has me, perhaps everything these days seems to reflect on our current very unusual situation, which is that during the pandemic and during more isolation and quarantining, that both finding who we are from who we've been, but also trying to maintain some sense of identity or remembrance, or even, you know, that sense of letting go of expectation of what should have been, could have been. A lot of these are lessons that feel like they play into right now very much.
I agree. Yeah, the pandemic is an act of nature. If it makes people suddenly step out their house and help a handing hand to their neighbor, do something for somebody, like do shopping for somebody they don't even know, right? That's an act of God. that's where you see the true beauty of the potential beauty of humanity. And being in lockdown forces you to rethink what is essential. What the beauty of a collaborative experience really is now that you can't have it, right?
There's a lot with both realizing, I guess, that I can't do quite all the things I used to do, and to not even let your conversations turn into, but what if we, you know, what we can't do, and then finding what you can. I guess a lot of that idea of remember to forget really caught me as I was thinking about it.
Of course, you know, like everything that we experience now is sort of like, it's only in cycles, because we're not living in the end of times. We're living during a time of transition. The downside of the suffering of the pandemic is obvious. Like, millions of people have fallen ill. By now, unfortunately, millions of people globally have died from COVID-19. The transition is that it has forced, scientists, humanity or scientists, to develop novel antiviral strategies that we never had before. So the aftermath of the pandemic is that we suddenly will have actual tools to treat viral disease, which we didn't have before. So we come out bigger and better and stronger. So all these things are transitions. That what we should hope for is that the moment that we come out of this pandemic, that we remember, very consciously, deliberately remember the positive lessons that we can learn from that, in terms of, what is the value of being able to visit your family or to see your parents or your grandparents or your children, etc. So, and those are things to remember when things get better and open up again. And we don't go back to the same type of, poor appreciation, for instance, of the arts and classical music, or sports events, etc., etc.
That's, I'd say, even I love going to concerts and I love music, but there are some points where I think, oh, I'm tired from work, another thing, I'm going to go sit next to people, and they're probably going to open their cough drops while I'm listening to the quiet, now I would love even to hear someone's cough drop wrapper opening in the quietest moment of a symphony.
Exactly. Yeah, we're getting zoomed out with concerts, right? I agree. It's don't take anything for granted, Mona. Mm-hmm.
So I do want to ask about a performance of yours that's been delayed, an opera. Is this your first? This is Goldwasser?
Yeah, Goldwasser is my first opera. We had dreams of opening night in Lincoln Center in New York last March. Well, we all remember what happened in March in New York, right? So that was delayed, and it's still going to be very challenging to get opera on stage during this year. But we're looking at all sorts of options and possibilities and alternatives to get Goldwasser to the public, and hopefully later this year.
And was, just as you talked about writing for the orchestra, this sort of difficult to describe experience that comes together just architecturally for you, what was it like approaching all the singers and the demands of the drama and all of that?
Actually, it started with reading a book. I read a family drama by a Dutch novelist, Ariella Kornmeel, the Goldwasser family. That's the title of the novel. And basically the story is, it's a coming of age story. A young woman who makes the transition of being a daughter in a family to becoming an independent woman in her own right and making her own choices. That's basically the premise of the story. And because it involves her having a partner who is in conflict with her father, and so there's a love relationship with the partner, there's a love relationship with the father, but there's a problem with the mother, there's definitely a big problem with the brother, etc. It's a real drama. And so after reading that novel, I thought that this story is really, you know, it's really the script for an opera because of all the drama in it, and the importance of the core of the story, which is that transition of being a child to becoming a grown up. And so then I did something very bad initially. I actually wrote the opera without having a libretto. So I composed all the music, all the scenes, all the voices, a large orchestra. It's like full symphony orchestra. This is not chamber opera. This is traditional opera in an old-fashioned sense, with five voices for, you know, the family member and the boyfriend. And then I thought, oops, you know, I have a 90-minute opera, but I need a libretto. And so, thank God, I found a genius here in Canada, Joel Ivany. He's the artistic director of Against the Grain, an opera company in Toronto. And he then wrote a libretto. I translated the novel for him, and then he wrote a libretto to the music, which is quite a feat. And so there we are.
Well, I very much look forward to perhaps being able to see that. Maybe I'll come down to Lincoln Center, or if it's able to come back there, or however it works in the future.
You'll be invited. Yeah, you'll be our guest of honor.
I have appreciated so much that you've been willing to talk both about music and then sort of, you know, expand philosophically as we're sort of just discussing the ideas behind it. Are there other things you're working on right now that are capturing your attention or on your plate?
Yes. So for this year, we're in pre-production of the third album with Leaf Music, my label here in Canada. It's not my label, but the label that contracted me, right? Third album is chamber music works, which will, you know, various pieces, including piano solo works, a piano quartet. I composed and commissioned three songs for soprano and baroque ensemble, which will be on that album as well. The next thing, maybe closer to your heart, I wrote a concerto for viola and orchestra, which hopefully we will be recording later this year as well. And very exciting is I was recently commissioned by the United Nations and the government of the Netherlands to write a new work on occasion of the celebration of the 75th anniversary of the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the UN, you know, the International Court of Justice of the UN. And that anniversary is in April, and is celebrated with a gala concert by Lavinia Meyer. She's a renowned harp player, harpist. And so the commission was to write a new concerto for harp and orchestra, and she will premiere that piece in by the end of April this year.
That is really amazing to connect to such amazing history and a wonderful celebration.
Yeah.
And of course, yes, yeah, selfishly, I am very happy to hear about a concerto for viola and look forward to hearing that.
I'll send you a copy.
Yeah. And then otherwise, during all of this, so you've been composing, are you still playing piano?
I try to squeeze that in daily at the start of the day, so like an hour and a half to, of course, when I compose, it's at the keyboard. So I play piano, 8, 9, 10 hours a day or so. But the old-fashioned practice of the piano, I have a beautiful, that's a story in itself. I don't know if you have time for it yet.
Tell me about the piano. I would love to.
We talked about the piano. So when I was still a young man, long hair and playing concerts, I did somebody a favor by opening up a new season in a new chamber music concert hall. Starting their program and attracting the audience and organizing the season, etc., etc. And I did that, you know, out of friendship and for the love of music, etc. And then about a year later, the gentleman responsible for that concert hall called me and he said, you know, I want to return the favor. Royal Concertgebouw. The concert hall in Amsterdam, the big concert hall, just ordered a new Steinway, and if you want, you can have the older one, the one that is being replaced. Now, the history of that one is exceptional. So the in the year that I was born, Arthur Rubinstein, who I hope we all remember, mm-hmm. At that time lived in Paris. And he was about to come to Amsterdam for his annual recital and wrote them a telegram to say, last year I was not happy with your piano. I want to bring my own piano from Paris and you have to pay for the transport. And they sent him a telegram back saying, well, wait a second, we just bought a new one. We like it. Come a day early, try it out. If you like it, you will use it. If you don't like it, we'll fly your piano in from Paris. So he comes a day early, he plays on it, and he likes it so much, he loves it so much, that he wants to buy it from them. But it's a government enterprise, so they're not in the business of selling pianos. They can't. So between 57 and 76, he came every year, played recitals, played with the orchestra, did recordings, every year played on that piano, and every year tried to buy it from them. But of course, they never did. And in 86, I think, in 84, 85, 86, they bought a new one and they gave me the old one, which is that piano. So I have, and it's been with me ever since. You know, my first apartment was so small that I slept under the piano, but I've traveled the world with it. It's been with me ever since. And so every time if you play on it, you know why Rubinstein liked that piano so much. It has an endless singing tone. It's a beautiful, Steinway from the golden era, from Hamburg Steinway. It's a beautiful instrument. So I'm married to that piano in a sense. But every morning I study my Bach and Beethoven and Chopin on Uncle Arthur's piano.
Oh, wow. What a treasure.
Yeah. It's the day Myra Hess. I mean, it's another name that probably nobody remembers. Myra Hess was a famous British concert pianist, and she was the first one to play on it when it was new, the first night. And to honor her introducing that piano to the audience, they painted her name on the soundboard. So it It's the Dame Myra Hess.
Well, I remember her for two reasons. One is that she's behind the popular arrangement of Yea's the Joy of Man's Desiring that everybody...
There you go. Good for you, Mona. That's her. Yeah, that's Myra Hess.
Yeah. The other thing, apparently she came here once to Rochester to play a fundraising concert for a community music school here known as the Hochstein School that just turned 100. And this school is named for David Hochstein, who is a Russian Jewish immigrant who lived in Rochester, who was an amazing violinist. George Eastman and other local philanthropists got him money to study in Europe with Auer and have a Stradivarius and go to Carnegie Hall. But then he signed up to fight in World War One.
I heard he was shot a few weeks before the end of the war. The end of the war. Yeah, I heard that story. It's terrible.
So that is, we have the school though made in his memory, but one of the fundraisers that helped establish that school as a place in the community, there's notes that some connection, somehow Dame Myra Hess came here and played in Rochester. Oh,
so. Wonderful. She would have played that encore, right?
Yeah, I'm assuming.
The Story of Man's Desire. Yes, wonderful.
That was actually at the end of one of the last concerts I heard before the pandemic. I was visiting family in Illinois and we went to Chicago and I saw Daniel Trifonov play The Art of the Fugue. And at the end of The Art of the Fugue, you know, no applause between each move, complete half, and then the other half, he went straight into that arrangement of Yea's the Joy of Man's Desiring was the conclusion after the full Art of the Fugue. So.
Oh, what a way to hear a concert before the lockdown. My God, you picked an incredible artist to hear. He's a phenomenal pianist.
That was, so I have that sort of to carry me through until we meet again, kind of.
Absolutely. Yes, that's wonderful. Wonderful.
Well, Jaap Hamburger, thank you so much for taking this time and speaking to me and sharing your music, which, again, I'm really taken in by the beauty and the drama of the music you write. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.